Welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Common Sense with me, Mike Omni. Thank you for listening. The US has been convulsed by nationwide protests over the death of an African-American man in police custody. George Floyd, 46, died after being arrested by police outside a shop in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Footage of the arrest on the 25th of May shows a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck whilst he was pinned to the floor. Mr. Chauvin, who's 44, has since been charged with murder. Now, the key events that led to Mr. Floyd's death happened within just 30 minutes. Based on accounts from eyewitnesses, video footage, and also official statements, here's what we know so far. It all began with a report of a fake $20 bill. A report was made on the evening of the 25th when Mr. Floyd bought a pack of cigarettes from Cup Foods, a grocery store. Believing the $20 bill he used was fake, a counterfeit, a store employee reported it to the police. Mr. Floyd had been living in Minneapolis for several years after moving there from Texas, where he's actually from. He had been working in the city as a bouncer, but like millions of Americans and people all around the world, including in the UK, he was left jobless because of the coronavirus pandemic. Now, Mr. Floyd was a regular at Cup Foods. He was a friendly face, a pleasant customer. In fact, the store owner said he had never caused any trouble. In a call to 911 made at 8:01, the employee told the operator that he had demanded the cigarettes be handed back, but Mr. Floyd didn't want to do that. The employee said that the man, Mr. Floyd, appeared drunk and not in control of himself. Shortly after that call, at 8:08, two police officers arrived. Mr. Floyd was sitting with two other people in a car parked around the corner. After approaching the car, one of the officers, Thomas Lane, pulled out his gun and ordered Mr. Floyd to show his hands. In an account of the incident, prosecutors did not explain why Mr. Lane thought it was necessary to draw his gun. In fact, I think many of us are still confused as to why he would bring his gun out. But anyways, Mr. Lane, prosecutor said, put his hand on Mr. Floyd and pulled him out of the car. Then Mr. Floyd actively resisted being handcuffed. Once handcuffed, though, Mr. Floyd became compliant with Mr. Lane. Mr. Lane explained why he was being arrested, that he was being arrested for passing counterfeit currency. It was when officers tried to put Mr. Floyd into their squad car that the struggle began. Around 8:14 p.m., Mr. Floyd stiffened up, fell to the ground, and told the officers that he was claustrophobic. Mr. Chauvin arrived at the scene. He and other officers were involved in a further attempt to put Mr. Floyd into the police car. We're now at 8:19. Mr. Chauvin pulled Mr. Floyd out of the passenger side, causing him to fall on the ground, a report said. He lay there, face down, still in handcuffs. This is when witnesses started to film Mr. Floyd, who appeared to be in a very distressed state. These moments captured on multiple mobile phones shared widely on social media, and they would prove to be Mr. Floyd's last. Mr. Floyd was restrained by officers. Mr. Chauvin placed his left knee between his head and neck. I can't breathe, Mr. Floyd said repeatedly, pleading for his mother and begging, please, please, please. For 8 minutes and 46 seconds, Mr. Chauvin kept his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck. About 6 minutes into that period, Mr. Floyd became non-responsive. In videos that we've all seen online of the incident, that's when Mr. Floyd fell silent as bystanders urged the officers to check his pulse. One of the other officers did just that, checking Mr. Floyd's right wrist, but couldn't find a pulse. Yet, the other officers did not move. At 8:27, Mr. Chauvin removed his knee from Mr. Floyd's neck, motionless. Mr. Floyd was rolled onto a gunnery and taken to a medical center in an ambulance. and was pronounced dead around an hour later. I'm joined today by Elijah Ajuwon, who is a writer for the Common Sense Network, but he also runs a social enterprise called Archisite, which is organized around diversifying the tech sector by enabling diverse talent into the tech sector. Elijah, how do you feel hearing the story?
Well, how I felt hearing the story, and it's the same way I felt hearing the stories that we've had in recent times in terms of the senseless killings of African Americans in America, is angry. That was my initial emotion. But then after I watched the video and after more and more details came out about this, it was confusion, more of why. I had a lot of questions, you know, and it now shifted from being angry to a state of confusion and being sad, because the way that he died was just so avoidable, number one, and very, very senseless. And I think little facts or just little pieces that people gloss over, like for the fact that one of the other officers couldn't find a pulse, and Mr. Chauvin did not remove, and Chauvin kept his knee on his neck for an extra 2 minutes. That to me, it was a sobering moment. That's what I was saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was equally confused. I mean, I watched it just before I went to bed. So this would have been around 9 p.m. And I remember shouting at my phone. I think I shouted, "Get off him," about three times, because I just didn't understand why this would happen. I mean, people have described it as murder, which is exactly what it is, because it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. I mean, I watched it and I thought, well, even if you were some sort of closet racist, heartless, whatever it is, I mean, why would you in broad daylight have your knee on someone's neck for over 7 minutes? Mm. I mean, it beggars belief. People haven't really gone into this, but that's something I've never understood, is why would you do that? I mean, what has to be going on in you to do that? And like you said, like many people around the world protesting in the UK and in America, we're just angry.
And what does it show? It shows that a lot of these cops who are sworn in to protect laws do not respect those laws that they've been sworn in to protect. They don't take into account, you know, I mean, when somebody's motionless, and I think as a police officer, even somebody has committed a crime, they are unconscious. And I think at that point, they're not a threat to you or to the public anymore. Yeah. You can literally do with them as you please. As an unconscious man, you can call the ambulance service if need be, or if you really want to and he comes around, you can literally drag him up and put him in the back of your car. So the fact that even though one of the officers did say that he was unresponsive and the other officer stayed there or stayed pinning him down and Mr. Chauvin kept his knee on his neck, to me, that's just a senseless murder. Yeah. And everybody and anybody who's angry, they're justified to be angry.
I mean, as we explained at the start of the report, that police officer has since been charged with murder. But I guess that funny taste doesn't leave your mouth, where you're trying to work out exactly what he was trying to achieve. Here's a man, as you've said, who has been sworn in to protect the people. At least that's what we think he's going to be doing. And then what we see here is a senseless murder in broad daylight of someone else. Now, you know, with Archisites, you're interested in community. You've got a community of Black people who are trying to get into the tech sector. I'm just wondering, how is your community dealing with this? What are some of their feelings?
Yeah, so in terms of the emotions that they've expressed to me, it varies. And in terms of their output as to how they express those emotions, it varies as well. So some people state anger, or everybody is angry. And there's some people who are incensed, you know, kind of like with rage. Some of them, actually the ones based in Manchester, actually joined the protest today in the city centre. And some of them have, you know, they are angry, but the way they express it is through writing. So they have Medium pages, or they've got blog pages where they kind of express their feelings and kind of put it out like that. So in terms of the community, people are dealing with this in different ways.
Yeah, that's important to highlight, because one thing we've seen online, and I spoke about this, is the suggestion that we all have to process this the same way, which obviously is not true. No. As you said, the writers are sitting down, mulling this over, trying to write something kind of edifying, and the protesters are outside protesting. I think everyone should be protesting if they can, and some people are doing that. And for some people that I've spoken to, this is just too much for them. As in, they are tired.
Yeah.
And they're in a state now where they're just, I mean, some of them are wrestling apathy, because that's another beast you have to wrestle. Mm. This notion that, you know, with every hashtag, you have to now get back on the street and protest. They're just tired of it all. They're tired of having to defend Black lives. It is so tiring to have to make YouTube videos telling people we matter. I mean, it's a non-starter. This is 2020. Why are we still having these conversations? It makes no sense. I feel so stupid when I have to go on Twitter and go, Black people are just like, I mean, I watched a video by Now This, which was, it was quite powerful. But what annoyed me was the fact that the video had to be made in the first place. It was of a Black man who was telling us all the different things that makes him, that makes up his identity. He said, "I'm a Black man, but I also know the lyrics to Oklahoma. I like this, I like that, normal things." And then he ended with, like, you know, "This is who I am." And I'm thinking, what a sorry world we live in, where people have to do that, like, have to explain their humanity and explain they're like everybody else. It's a joke, quite frankly. And you know, I guess just like you spoke about your community, everyone's dealing with this very, very differently. And I think everyone is everyone's justified in how they are dealing with this, especially the Black community. What I will not take, quite frankly, is being lectured to by white people or Asians or anybody else about how I should process my community's trauma. You don't get to tell me how I process my trauma. You know, and I've seen a bit of that online, which equally has kind of annoyed me. Now, a bit about race, because I want to ask you a question which someone asked to me, and I thought might be interesting to get your perspective. Now there's a lot on race, and you can read about race online. I thought I would give us a quick foray into the history of race. As we know, race as a categorizing term referring to human beings was first used in the English language, probably in the late 16th century, most people would agree. Until the 18th century, it had been used to kind of mean a group of people. You know, so synonyms of race were sort or kind. So you remember in some Shakespearean references, he would speak about a race of saints or a race of bishops, right? Now, by the 18th century, race was now being used widely to sort a ranking of people by in English colonies. So Europeans predominantly saw themselves as free, and they would rank people in their colonies, again, by their race, right? Now, racism or racialism is that ideology that human beings can be divided into separate and exclusive biological entities based on this idea that there's a causal link between their physical traits, their intellect, their morality. So then, that use in the descriptive sense over different centuries started to become used in a pejorative sense, and now in the late 20th century, this notion of race was now well defined, where some races thought they were innately superior to others. So white races thought that their English colonies that were colonized by them were less superior, and so that then permeated what we now popular discourse, where, you know, white people think they're normal, they're natural, they're free, and the colonized people, Black people, were Black, and by virtue of being assigned a race, were less than them. Now, people of course have spoken about the Spanish Inquisition and all these other kind of periods in history where racism and race was again really used, but that's the brief history. It was used to sort people by white people. That's what it was used to do. Now, here's the question I want to ask you that was asked to me, Elijah. When did you first realize you were Black?
Well, I can't really pinpoint the point where I first realized that I was Black, but I can tell you that my parents allowed me to know that I was Black. And when they did so, I didn't really get the significance of it. So they would always tell me, even in secondary school, if your white counterparts are getting 80%, I mean, if your white counterparts are getting 50%, you as a Black man needs to get 80%, you know, to be seen on the same playing field. And I never understood that, because the secondary school that I went to, if you know me or another school I went to, it was 95% Black, and 5% was, you know, anything else around the globe. So for me, them saying that, I'm thinking, well, but nobody's here for me to actually make that comparison to.
So from a young age, they had been trying to make you understand that you need to work harder than white people in order for you to achieve the same things they have to, or you need to perform better than them, basically.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And what did that? I know it's a bit hard to ask because you'd have been young, but
yeah,
what were you thinking hearing that?
Well, so I was thinking, I just don't get the logic. I don't know why. Because even at a young age, I was still kind of breaking things down forensically. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, why would an institution, let's say college or university, if I was thinking that far ahead, why would they take somebody who is by the metrics of an exam, not as smart as me? Because I was thinking from a logical point of view, I mean, of course, it's a no-brainer. If somebody meets, if you've got two people and they both meet your criteria, you're going to want to take the smartest one if you're talking about institutions. And as I grew up and I look back at that, it was just clearly not true. And as I've been growing older, I've actually understood what they're trying to get at more and more.
Yeah. Well, I think many Nigerians particularly, but just black people listening to you will understand that. Now, I grew up the same way. My parents would often say, you know, if you want to succeed in this world, you need to work 3 times as hard as your white counterparts. Yeah. And being young, I remember being confused by like, yeah, but Billy is just my friend from school. Why? Yeah. Like, we're the same.
Yeah.
And I just didn't get that concept. In fact, I think the first time I really understood race was when in primary school, one of the kids called me a milky butt. No, he called me a milk chocolate.
In primary school?
Yeah, he said you're milk chocolate. I think he called me Frodo or Fredo. Oh, do you remember the Fredo chocolate bar?
Yeah,
he called me a Fredo and I didn't, you know, we all laughed kind of thing. And I called him a milky bar. And I was like, you're a milky bar.
Mm.
And then he went to tell the teacher that I called him a milky bar.
My days.
Weasel, I know, yeah. Ridiculous. Even though he said, called me a thing. And so then he went to the teacher and then they said, did you call him a milky bar? And I said, yes. And I said, that was racist. And that's the first time I heard the term racist. Now, I won't say the school name, right? But then I was brought to the principal's office.
Oh, wow.
They called my parents in and we had to have a meeting about me espousing racist kind of thought. And that was quite interesting to me because, of course, we know that race isn't... prejudice is different from race.
Yeah.
Race... typically, based on the popular understanding of race, you need to have power.
Mm.
Race is about structures. It's about systems. It's not about me and you having a conversation on the street. So how funny is it that my introduction to racism was a white boy who had called me milk chocolate before, me then retaliating and calling me a milky bar, I was then sanctioned by the very system that actually puts his interest before mine.
So he didn't get in trouble in any way, shape, or form?
No trouble at all. Now, of course, they'll say it's kids. We can't ascertain he was telling the truth and he was lying.
Yeah.
But that always struck me. That was my first introduction to race, was that I was called a racist because the white kid at the time thought me calling him Milky Bar was a reason for him to tell the authority, the teachers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they didn't ask me, like, you know, what was my story. They just said, you're not allowed to say that. That's racist. And I was sanctioned for it.
I don't even know what to say. Because at such a young age, because you said primary school as well.
Yeah, primary school. I would have been in year 5 during this time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, and the school you went to, what was the diversity like in terms of, you know, who was a dominant?
It was a dominantly white school.
Yeah.
I couldn't say it was predominantly black by any stretch. It was definitely predominantly white. But again, race wasn't a feature like that. We just, you know, when you were a child, you wanted to be dragons.
Yeah, you didn't really care about race.
You wanted to be a lion. It was people that introduced race to you. So our parents prepared us.
Yeah.
And I was born in Nigeria. I came here and already my mom was telling me, you're not going to be like, there's going to be a lot of people who aren't like you.
Mm.
And I struggled because I looked around and no one looked like me. But you know, again, you don't really look in the mirror when you're a child like that. You're not looking in the mirror going, why is this on my face? You just want to have fun.
Mm.
So it's a shame that my introduction to race wasn't a helpful one. It was quite sour, actually.
Yeah.
And again, I never thought about it until I was made to think about it by the very systems out there.
Mm. And I just think that it's very, very interesting because throughout my school life, up until I got to university, I went to predominantly black schools. So for me, being introduced to racism just wouldn't have happened in the school or in my school because, again, we didn't see things like that first and foremost. And then we are the dominant, quote unquote, people in the school and even reflected in the teachers as well. So for example, if you took our maths department, every single person there was from West Africa. So they understood our culture, they understood the way to get to us, and the way to understand us as well.
Yeah.
So we didn't really see race as a thing. It was like, okay, we've got the same environment that we do at home. But I guess that perhaps for me, it could have been somewhere in the streets of Bermondsey, where I grew up. And back then it was nowhere near as diverse as it is now. But I can't really pinpoint the time that I knew that I was black. But
yeah.
It's interesting just to hear your story and to hear how the fact that because you went to a predominantly white school, you were introduced to racism at a much, much more earlier age than I was.
It's very helpful to think about it sometimes, as in, you know, where this whole concept comes from. Obviously, I've gone on to study race extensively since, but that's where it first started. I didn't, of my own volition, try and do research into racism. Mm. No, it was actually people telling me that I was being racist by performing a racist act, as it were. Now, of course, George Floyd, as we've discussed, has changed the world, quite frankly. I mean, there are protests in Tokyo.
Mm.
We've seen protests happening in the UK.
Yeah.
We've seen protests happening in America as well. And we've seen some interesting takes. And I want us to talk about some of the takes. It's very helpful, I think, to discuss how our community, but also other people, are reacting to this, and to ask what we can learn from this. You know, one take I've seen is that, well, this video should not be shared because it's normalizing black death, and it's not good to normalize black death. Is this something you agree with? I remember you saying something similar to this.
Yes, it is normalizing black death, and it's made me become desensitized to seeing seeing black people being killed, but it's still very, very powerful to see it. So I've been following Sean King, and he'll always tweet about, you know, about the injustices in America, especially towards African Americans, rather. And seeing the tweets, as in a black man's been killed in America, you could read that and be like, oh, another one, really? But then seeing it actually happen. So I remember watching the case or watching the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery. I hope I didn't butcher his name.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, if you were to read a tweet and you see the video, you have two completely different emotions.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way anybody can tell me that they felt as enraged or as angry or as sad reading the tweet than it did watching the video. And it wasn't for that video coming out and surfacing. People wouldn't have had the reactions that they had.
Yeah.
And if that reaction didn't take place, the two men who actually killed him wouldn't have been tried. And they wouldn't have been found. Well, they haven't been sentenced yet. So it's very, very powerful to have the video out there, but I don't understand the point in terms of it is normalizing black death.
See, this is where I disagree, because I don't think it's normalizing black death at all. Mainly because we're not watching this for voyeurism. This isn't people watching these as a show or telling their friends, let's watch it together. This is a necessity. You know, it's well documented that when we don't remember history, it repeats itself.
Yeah.
And I think the more we ignore these kind of videos because they're graphic or we don't want to talk about them. I mean, it takes me back to a debate people were having about not teaching black history in terms of slavery anymore, because it said it was too distressing for the students.
Mm.
And I said, well, hold on. We have to live this.
Yeah.
Distressing for them to think about it. Mm. Well, try living it.
Mm.
Try living it. Here's a man who lived a life where he was murdered, right? Murdered. His life was a life of just, you know, lots of beautiful moments, I'm sure, but also struggle that culminated in murder. And people are saying it's too distressing to think about, so they don't want to watch. I mean, that's just ridiculous, because for me, you have to know these things.
Mm.
The whole point of filming isn't because we like filming these things. It's because if people don't see it, they don't know. Of course, we would all love to live in a bubble where this isn't an issue. But the thing is, it is an issue, right? And we need to know about it. The truth of the matter is, I question whether we would be having this conversation, doing this podcast, if there was no video.
Mm.
If it was just someone who tweeted, oh, a guy was killed, someone knelt on his head and he died, I mean, we would be enraged. But again, we get tweets of black people dying all the time.
Yeah.
Someone said it. There's not more racism happening. It's being filmed now. And we can see it. And there's something about seeing that there's a visceral reaction when you see and know that this isn't a film. This is someone's life. And I don't understand. I mean, I get people who are saying for their mental health, they want to not watch it and whatever. But as far as I see it, it's reality.
Mm.
And it's so important, obviously, as a journalist, I think it's important to see these things just for work.
Yeah.
But I would hate for my children to not be taught Black history and taught the all these hard materials, sensitive materials. I would hate for them not to see it because I felt it was too triggering for them.
Mm.
I think we lose something important when we don't watch these kind of videos.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think that a disconnect happens in terms of the severity of what is actually going on. There are some people who can empathize depending on proximity. So after depending on proximity towards an issue, that's why some people, you know, may not care about world hunger in Africa. Poverty rather in Africa, but they will care more about the homelessness issue in a place close to them. And I think that watching the video will actually allows people to let's say connect with the emotions a bit more and actually understand how much of a problem this actually is.
Absolutely,
because you've seen the brutal murder of African Americans in the States.
And you're right. I am not against anyone's personal desire to protect their peace. I mean, do it, protect your peace. But making the statement that not watching this is somehow a virtuous thing to do is what I have a problem with. Mm. When people say I'm not watching it because this is wrong, when normalizing death is that, when no one's watching it and happy to be watching it.
Yeah.
We're enraged. Have you seen the people who've watched it and their reaction after?
Mm.
They're not going, that was fun. They're enraged, they're angry. And for young people, it's so important they're aware of what's going on. That we don't whitewash this and go, oh, just an inconvenient truth, let's move on.
Mm.
It's literally that debate again. I was having a chat with a friend last year. He was saying that we're talking about Black history, and he was like, well, you know, it's happened. What's happened's happened. Let's move on. And I said, are you joking? That sounds like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Let's move on. What's literally going to happen is what we're seeing now.
Mm.
People forget. They forget. Human beings have a wonderfully fickle memory when it comes to checking their biases. And for me, I don't mind having the uncomfortable conversation. I think it's necessary. Now, one thing we've seen equally during this time is Donald Trump, and he's seemingly confusing flip-flop.
Yeah.
When the death, when George Floyd was first killed, we saw him tweet a very presidential tweet. He said he was ordering the federal government to look into this and talking to the Attorney General, and he said this is an injustice. And then we started seeing looting happening or protest and looting. Of course when you protest, there's always going to be a couple of dissenters that are a bit more that have a criminal desire in mind, and so we saw protests break out in Minneapolis and Minnesota. And he then a few days later, after tweeting, you know, we're going to root this out and really filling people with hope that he cares about this issue, he then parrots something said by a white supremacist years ago, and he says, when they start looting, we start shooting.
Mm.
I mean that broke my heart. You know, Donald Trump is someone who's always confusing me, because when I think he's outdone himself with stupidity, he always finds a deeper level to go to. But I thought he had reached a pinnacle in recent months. And when I saw this, I thought to myself, the leader of the free world is threatening and advocating killing unarmed Black people.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone's looting, it's criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
They should be arrested,
mm-hmm.
prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that he would say they should be shot. I mean, did you see this, and what did you think about it?
Oh, I saw it. And it was one of those things where I kind of laughed. I not laughed because, haha, it's funny, but laughed in, is this guy being serious? Is he being real? Somebody has just been killed in cold blood. He's just the latest in a chain of killings, especially this month. And you and people are protesting. Okay, you know, it can turn out, you know, into a riot and to be violent. But then to now respond with that when the looting starts, we're gonna start shooting. I just think it's ridiculous. The US has got, to borrow David Cameron's term, a fantastically corrupt justice system in itself, and people have been rioting, quote unquote, for less, and looting for less. We actually seen it this year in terms of the lockdown in certain states. People have looted and rioted because their sports teams have won. I mean, we saw it with the Denver Broncos in the 90s. We saw it with Boston anytime they won the World Series in the noughties. In fact, even as recent as 2018, when the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl, there was rioting
yeah.
in Philadelphia, and that's because of sports. But nobody wanted to bring the guns out then.
No,
but
he didn't tweet that then.
But now, because of injustice, or now because people are responding to injustice, especially in the corrupt injustice system that I've got in America, now I want to bring out the guns.
Again, like I said, it's baffling, because I guess the problem with Donald Trump is, obviously, let's not forget, he was the host of a game show. That's his history. He was hosting a game show. He thinks, and I think he's actually, you know, what I think, if I was to psychosomatically try to understand him, it seems as though he thinks life is this big game show. So in November, you've got the grand bonanza. Right, you got the election, and so every single few weeks or so, he tries to appeal to a different political cleavage. When he sees that he's losing African Americans, he goes, let's backtrack a bit. When he sees that he's losing evangelical Christians, he goes, you know what, we're gonna open churches as a state of because it's an emergency. So he's gonna open churches even when the R number, the rate of infection number with the coronavirus, is still quite high in America, above one in most states. He goes, let's let churches meet again, because he wants to throw them red meat.
Yeah.
When he sees that he's losing African Americans, when there's a death, he goes, oh, as an opportunist, as a game show host, he goes, oh, this is a chance to win some votes. So he goes, this is disgusting. I'm going to get the Attorney General on this. This will be rooted out. Injustice has no place. Mm. And suddenly, some African Americans were actually pleased to see him taking it seriously. A couple of days later, when he starts seeing the All Lives Matter Brigade and the ex-KKK folk walking out going, our country, suddenly he starts to parrot what a racist said years ago. This man has no spine. He has no ideology. He has no core beliefs. He is like a duffer bag. He just moves with the wind. He does whatever he wants. And it's a shame that when he's meant to be setting the mood for our country, when people are looking for leadership, they look at the presidency and it's vacant. It's empty because there's an obtuse orange, quite frankly, that's there, that's incapable of providing leadership at a time like this. It gets me so angry.
I'm not the biggest fan of politicking and using the current situations that people are going through for your own political gains. But there are times, I mean, there isn't really times where you should, but if there is a time where you shouldn't, this is the time. This is not the time to start pandering to people's political ideologies and beliefs, because it just shows that they do not care about your country as a whole. You don't care about the peace in your country, and you don't care about the lives of certain individuals or certain types of individuals in your country. And again, as I said earlier on, that statement, it made me laugh, but it made me laugh in kind of disbelief.
I mean, another thing that's really annoyed me is, I guess, you know, I'm a libertarian, and I think that's well documented, but the brand responses and their desire to capitalize on this trauma has really made me quite confused. I mean, the Nike campaign, which, you know, at first glance seems really well done, if we think about what's happening here, these are big brands branding their response. You know, don't do it. For once, don't do it. A playoff on their slogan. It's like, what do you think we are? Just up for... Just make a statement. Let us know what you think and keep it moving.
Yeah,
I don't understand that everyone using their brand and their logo to spin it into, like, the fact that people are sat around the room debating how best to use their brand, and they've got the wrong priorities. You want to care about Black lives? One, value them before stuff like this happens.
Yeah.
By employing them, by training them, by investing in their community. Number one.
Yeah.
When this does happen, give some money, create the spaces, empower the people. Don't put out some stupid branded statement on Twitter or on Instagram and then rack up your likes and go, that's it, guys, we're done. Let's just wait for this to blow over so we can go back to selling them stuff, because ultimately it's their money we want. So this weird benevolent capitalism, we love people capitalism, co-opting protests and using it to further raise their share prices. I mean, it's crazy to think about, but it's a shame because we've actually bought into this system where these big brands, when they see Black Death, some I'm sure mean it, you know, sincerely, but the system itself, it creates this, and it's happened with the Common Sense Network. People have messaged me like, where's your statement? And I was like, we're thinking about it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put out a stupid statement and say, oh, use your common sense. Black death. Like, I'm not going to do that. And it really does frustrate me where when all these brands, people then, and people start clapping for them and going, yeah, look at them. They love us.
They did their bit. Nah.
What have they done for your community, man? Like, what have they done for your community?
I think it, that just speaks about the social and responsibility part of these organizations. You know, if you have to go on their sites, you'll see everything that they're doing for their communities. They're helping LGBTQ people. They're helping and refugees. They're doing fair trade, But when things like this, so when things actually hit the fan, you can tell that it's just lip service. If you take Ben and Jerry's, for example, I'm not trashing it in any way, shape, or form. When this issue started to, you know, kind of gain some legs on social media, they released a statement. Just a statement, no branding, no nothing. Just a statement as to how they felt about this issue and how they're helping African-American communities who are suffering from this. And that is the type of thing that I commend. An organization who has got a real dedication towards, you know, towards social responsibility, whatever that is, and whatever form that takes. And that's the type of thing that I commend.
Absolutely. I mean, I wish I saw more of that. I mean, in a similar vein, we've seen celebrities being forced to. I mean, I saw something really odd online where people online kept on saying, oh, well, you know, this is on Twitter and on social media, just more generally, you know, forcing celebrities to put out statements and saying, where's John? Why hasn't John done his statement? And then John comes out and tweets some awkwardly worded tweet and then has to go back and say something. I mean, it's just this utopian, because you kind of go, we're talking about the issue. We're talking around the issue, but not the issue.
Yeah.
I don't care what the celebrity has to do or say. Mm. I mean, who cares what he has to say? I care about the people affected. Like, that's what I'm interested in. What's with this dragging celebrities? And these folks have no influence. Influence over things that really matter. So your favorite model, whether he tweets or not, who really cares? Mm. You know, anyone can have a publicist write something for them that sounds lovely and put it out. Why are you looking for that? Why is that what you're fascinated or interested in?
I'm not trying to drag this person, but I remember a day or two ago, people were asking on Twitter, where's Jack Fowler? Where's Jack Fowler in this? And then Jack Fowler now releases a statement and people now get onto him. Irrespective of that, what do you want Jack Fowler to do? I don't mean to disrespect him, but what do you want a Love Island, not even winner? Like, what do you want him to do when we're talking about a salient issue as big as racism? How is he going to change policies? How is he going to kind of... I mean, to me, it baffles me. And I think that what a lot of people are doing is they actually want to shift responsibility, you know, of actually having to do things to other people, to the celebrities, because, you know, they're celebrities, so they should do everything. Instead of, you know, actually taking action themselves, they think, you know, I've tweeted, I've not added this... celebrities, so I've now done my part. Well, but no, you haven't, because your community is being affected by this. So what are you doing?
It speaks of the disconnect between USA and America and the UK, because I think I've seen the majority of this. And by inadvertently, I'm obviously in the UK right now, so my Twitter feed is heavily British, and so I've seen most of this in the British kind of from British influencers.
Yeah.
I don't imagine American folk who are in Minneapolis are tweeting, where are these celebrities? I mean, they're not interested in that. Mm. They've got actual issues. They're organizing. They're meeting their communities. There's a vote going on right now. Like they're really thinking about that, and that's what we ought to be doing. And the reason why I think the UK often engages with racism in America in a very odd way is because we've got our own very unique experience. Now, I don't want to go through the history of race in the UK, but you know, we have a very particular experience here.
Yeah.
The UK absolutely is racist. We all know this. And this isn't... And you know, the reason why I say that is because it's true, but I don't want our white listeners to listen to that and think I'm diagnosing them with some disease that they cannot be rid of and they're now cast into a... No. I'm saying the way structures are put in place... And the way we think about power in the UK is sullied by the history of empire. Mm. You cannot get away from the fact that this country exported their version of democracy pretty much to about over 60% of the world.
Yeah.
They exported it. And part of that wasn't negotiating with African leaders. It was leading with guns. It was leading with fire. It was leading with brimstone. With that being said, now when people are exported from those colonies, or ex-colonies rather, into the UK, you cannot then say there is no structural effect that comes into place. Mm. So how does it materialize in the UK? Well, one, look at a very basic level, confusing sports stars. We've seen it, the mainstream media, when Kobe Bryant died, will put a picture of LeBron James and goes, oh, oops, well, we thought they're the same. Or Stormzy, they'll put a picture of Lukaku and go, oh, no, oh, sorry, guys. I mean, it's so difficult. This is a major broadcasting network that confuses things. We see in microaggressions, which people speak about in the corporate sector, but pretty much in any sector, where, you know, if you're a black woman showing a bit of passion, you're angry, you know, you can't wear certain hairstyles because there's a Eurocentric beauty standard here in the UK. We see it in representation. The fact that we make up over 3% of the population, but if you look at the mainstream media and journalism, 0.1% are black.
Mm.
I mean, that's just ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous. It's so covert here. It's so swept under the rug. It's so subtle that some may actually be misguided into thinking maybe it doesn't exist. But of course, we know it does exist.
Yeah.
We just have a harder time finding it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing an article by somebody who was trying to cover the top 100 journalists in the UK. And 99 of the 100 were white. And the only one that was there who was a non-white Brit was actually an American.
Yeah.
So you should have made the list in the first place. And that just shows the kind of racism that there is in the UK. Because if these people can control the news, then you know all the biases that they have, conscious or unconscious, and all the views that they keep in the closet at home because they don't want anybody to actually label them with any sort of term.
Yeah.
It will proliferate in the news.
Absolutely.
And then it's a top-down effect because they control what's being said, they say what's being said, and then people consume it and eat it. In fact, it even gets to a point where sometimes the news can actually change the way somebody actually feels about a certain situation.
Absolutely.
Which means that you can kind of force your racist ideals on people in the country without anybody actually knowing how it's happening and how it's taking place. But when the people in power are all white, then what else do we expect?
I mean, all you have to do is flick through the Daily Mail and just see the deluge you get there of headlines and the way black people are treated. But you know, we've got so many issues here. And I guess when rooting out racism here in the UK, that is, you have to get a bit smart because it hides. It's harder to kind of find. Some people call it the boogeyman. Oh, what, racism in the UK? We don't have that here. We love everybody. I mean look, we have black people in positions of power, and we have some black CEOs and all these other things that people say, which is just a way to really push the issue away. You know, see, I think if we focused more on rooting out racism here, then we wouldn't get so involved in trying to parrot what's happening in America, but in a quite silly way here.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the discussions I've seen online, like I said, chasing celebrities. Some people spend the whole day looking for celebrities online to harass, basically, into releasing some weird statement.
Yeah.
Keeping on the topic of Love Island, I remember seeing Uvi, I think his name is.
Ovi. Ovi, I saw that picture.
Tweet a picture about just ridiculously tasteless random picture about being black, and then he was forced to apologize after because he was like, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it." I'm thinking, what? You shouldn't have said anything. If I'm honest, like, yeah, just tweet the link for the petition, or tweet a donation link, or just tweet hashtag Black Lives Matter. Like, just if you want to say something, just don't try to be funny. A thought leader, because you're not a thought leader, quite frankly. Right, I want us to move on and talk about, I guess, some helpful ways that we can mourn. You know, as we said at the start, people can mourn however they like. I'm actually working on a series of articles talking about lamenting and mourning. I'm not going to sit here and tell people how to mourn.
Yeah.
That's a waste of time. It's something people think they're virtuous in doing, and really they're just wasting their time. So we're not going to do that. What I want us to do instead is to think, well, what are some of the things people can do that would be very helpful during this time.
Yeah.
What the one is supporting petitions. We've made mention of it already. Mm-hmm. There are numerous petitions. Some calling for the case of I think it's BJ. I forgot her name. Is it Billy or B? It was a woman who was spat at at the tube. Right, she worked in the tube and she was spat at. I forgot her name, but there's a petition going on right now to have a case reviewed. This is here in the UK because they found that she, the people, well, the investigation revealed that there was nothing else that can be done, and they're moving on.
Yeah.
What's her name?
I'm still
You searching for it?
Yeah, I'm searching for it. BJ is actually the name of one of my friends, and I know that's not her name, but it's something similar to that. She's actually got a similar first name and last name. I think it's Beanie Mill. Oh gosh, I forgot.
I can find it. Belly.
Belly, that's it.
Yeah, it's Belly Mujinga.
Yeah, that's it.
So there's petitions, but there's also petitions about George Floyd that's going on right now. I think it's just over 8 million signatures. So that people can do that.
Yeah.
What else can they do?
I'll just say that people can, if they actually care about the communities here in the UK, they can contribute to the community. They can volunteer to a youth club, albeit when they cannot open. And I think you can, if you want to, you can also donate to organizations as well. And if you really, really feel passionate about this thing, want to make it a life project, you can aim to get into places where you can make policy changes and you can educate institutions on things like unconscious biases and racism in the UK.
Well, donating to charities is important because oftentimes we speak about these things and, as you said, we keep it moving until the next hashtag comes out. But one of the best ways you can be an ally or you can help the situation is to donate. Put your money where your mouth is and support financially institutions that are working at the precipice of a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
They're on the front line. They're educating people. I feel very passionate about people speaking to young people in their community, mentoring people, really trying hard to be a positive influence in your actual community. That's what I think people ought to be doing rather than tweeting online, is actually go and engage in your community, ask young people, what are you seeing? I saw the chief marketing officer, I think, at LinkedIn speaking about how she's white, and she was talking about how her daughter or son was angry, and she, rather than be like, oh, let's just move on, sat down and tried to teach the child like what was going on and engaging and having really uncomfortable conversations. My pastors at the Ramp Church in Manchester, we've had uncomfortable conversations about race and how to deal with it, and I love that. That's allyship. That's people going, teach me, not going, this is what should be done, this is how you should do it, but going, teach me your experiences. I want to learn. I don't want to sit down, and this is not an exercise, it's not a quick thing. I want to learn about your community. So that's what people can do as well. But of course, the last thing that we must do is we must organize. We have to get into positions of power where we can teach, where we have influence. This is what I'm doing on the Common Sense Network, I believe. And this is what I think you're doing by joining us, but also people are doing, is that they're not just going, oh, we wish there was a better, but they're actually putting out their hands and saying, I'm going to help build a better.
Yeah.
And I think if we have that, more people saying, I'm going to help build a better world, I think things may actually just get that little bit better.
I mean, just to speak on your point in terms of the CMO of LinkedIn talking to a child, I think that is super, super important to educate people. But not just to educate, white people, but also to educate black people as well as to the reasons why things are happening. Because a lot, in my community or the communities I've been involved in London, there are some black let's not call them men or adults, but there are some black people who do not like or hate their white counterparts due to what's happened due to what has happened to them or to their ancestors in the past, and the fact that they just hate them and they don't want to actually do anything about it to change it, I think that all stems from a lack of education, because sometimes they believe that, you know what, this is happening, but we can't do anything about it but to accept it, but I don't want to accept it. And as a reason, there's just so much hatred being pumped up. And what you don't want in two or three or four generations' time is for this to actually widen. But what you do want in two or three or four generations' time is for there to be a shift in mentality.
Absolutely.
A shift in school of thought. A shift, the way we empathize and relate to each other and understand the differences in our culture and the struggles that we're going through.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's super important.
There's a number of books and you know, at risk of saying some and snubbing other people, I won't mention the exact ones, but you know, if you are interested in finding more, find out more about this, the Common Sense Network, tcsnetwork.co.uk. We're going to have a stream of articles looking at this from different perspectives, literally out from Monday. So please be a part of that. Mm. It's been great having you here, Elijah. I mean, you know, we cannot in a conversation solve racism,
yeah.
Nor can we in a conversation provide answers to everything. We have to not relent. We have to keep on going.
Mm.
And, you know, I do hope over time I get to see a better world built where and no one has to ever watch that type of video again. Folks, thank you for listening to this special episode of Let's Talk Common Sense with Mike Omani. Please do subscribe if you haven't done so. And if you have enjoyed this conversation and find it helpful in some way, then please consider sharing it on Instagram, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, whatever social media outlets you use. Send it to a loved one. And we hope it spurs you on to discussing more and sharing more. Thank you for listening. Until the next one. Goodbye.